VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. North Korea has started preparing for a second summit between leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump sent a letter to Kim through North Korean Vice Chairman Kim Yong-chol, one of the country's highest-ranking officials, who met with Trump at the White House last week. The report did not specify what the goals are, but Trump would like to see North Korea rid itself of its nuclear weapons, while Kim wants international sanctions lifted so he can work on improving the North's economy. Kim and Trump promised to work toward the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula at their first summit in Singapore in June, but neither side specified how that goal will be met, and little progress toward getting there has been made so far. North Korea is still a nuclear power, and the U.S. has not eased any of the sanctions against it. The time and place for the second summit has yet to be announced, but President Trump has said it will probably happen in February. Political turmoil and uncertainty continues in Venezuela after U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Juan Guaido as interim leader.
Maduro told U.S. diplomatic personnel they had 72 hours to leave the country. The socialist leader started a second term earlier this month following a widely boycotted election last year that many foreign governments described as a sham.
We recognize and express our full support for the interim presidency of Venezuela.
Following Trump's support for Guaido, similar statements came from Canada and a slew of right-leaning Latin American governments, including Venezuela's neighbors Brazil and Colombia. Experts say ultimately a change in government in Venezuela will rest on a shift in allegiance within the armed forces. They have stood by Maduro through two violent waves of street protest, a collapsing economy, and a steady dismantling of democratic institutions.
That's Reuters' Jillian Kitchener reporting. This is VOA News. The increasingly personal showdown between President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has a new twist. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
It's now a case of dare and double dare. Pelosi had asked the president to delay next Tuesday's State of the Union address until the government reopens. He told her today he'd show up as planned. Pelosi is now denying him access to the House chamber and says he will not be allowed to address a joint session of Congress while the shutdown continues.
Very sad. I think it's a very, very bad thing for our country, and it's a horrible precedent.
The president says he'll do something in the alternative, which he did not reveal, but it won't have the grand backdrop or tradition of a House chamber speech, the kind of thing this president especially enjoys. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S. Senate is preparing to vote on competing partisan efforts to end a partial federal government shutdown now in its second month, but neither proposal has an easy path through Congress to reach President Trump's desk. On Thursday, the Senate is expected to vote on a Republican measure incorporating Trump's $5.7 billion demand for wall construction along the U.S.-Mexico border, plus limited immigration reforms and a package to fund the government for the rest of the current fiscal year. The Senate also will vote on a Democratic proposal to fund the government through February 8th. It contains no border security or immigration provisions. Russia showed a cruise missile system to foreign military attaches and journalists on Wednesday in an attempt to disprove Washington's allegation that it violates an arms treaty. Reuters' Francesca Linné.
The U.S. says the system isn't compliant with the Cold War-era Arms Control Pact, the INF Treaty, because of its long range. And so Washington has threatened to pull out of the 1987 pact. But Russia disagrees. To prove it, the country's deputy foreign minister displayed it at a news briefing, which was also broadcast on state TV. Russia has accused Washington of inventing the violation in order to exit the agreement, something that would allow the U.S. to develop its own new missiles.
That's Reuters' Francesca Linné reporting. A new study by a defense analysis company indicates that there was a 33% drop in global terror attacks in 2018, and terrorism fatalities fell to a 10-year low. Jane's Terrorism and Insurgency Center released its annual Global Attack Index Wednesday, saying one of the central reasons for the decrease in incidents and fatalities was the decrease in violence in Syria, where the government has gained control of territory previously occupied by Islamic State militants. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Felix Tshisekedi will be sworn in today as president of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
What people expect is the coming true of the dream for a pacific transfer of power between the outgoing President Kabila and ingoing President Tshisekedi.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. Sierra Leone civil society organizations and NGOs appeal once more to the government to reconsider its new NGO policy. South Sudan's government resumes oil production in its former unity state. And Italy accuses France of bankrupting Africa.
Di Maio accused France of impoverishing 14 African countries that use the CFA franc, a colonial-era currency underpinned by the French Treasury, and forcing people to flee to Europe.
That's correspondent Henry Ridgewell in London. We'll tell you about the potential to develop a vaccine for Lassa fever and a tribute this morning to Zimbabwe music icon Oliver Mtukudzi, who passed away yesterday, Wednesday. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Felix Tshisekedi will be sworn in today as president of the Democratic Republic of Congo to succeed President Joseph Kabila, who led the country for 18 years. Tshisekedi was declared winner of the country's December 30th election and certified by the Constitutional Court. His inauguration will be the first peaceful transition of power in the history of the DRC. Meanwhile, President Kabila addressed the nation for the last time Wednesday night with an appeal to Congolese to give their support to the new president. Andre Alain Atundu, spokesman for President Kabila's ruling coalition, says today is a joyful day for all Congolese.
What people expect is the coming true of the dream for a pacific transfer of power between the outgoing President Kabila and ingoing President Tshisekedi. So people is waiting with hope that this act will open a new era of living together, not as enemy, but as partner.
As you know, the last election, there's been some dispute about the election. The fact that we are having this inauguration, what does this mean about democracy in DRC?
Dispute about results is normal everywhere. But the announcement or the judgment of the Constitutional Court put an end to this dispute. Now we have to go to the next step, inauguration and beginning to work.
President Tshisekedi, when he is inaugurated on Thursday, will have to name a prime minister. Is it likely that he could pick Fayulu? How does it work?
No. I think, first of all, he has to identify the majority group in the parliament. And it seems the majority group is the group of President Kabila. Constitutionally, he has to choose the prime among this group of more than 330 members of parliament. And then the prime will form the government.
Mr. Atundu, outgoing President Joseph Kabila spoke to the Congolese people on Wednesday night. What did he have to say?
First of all, he began by reminding the circumstances of his coming in power, the death of the president, the assassination of the president, Moise Kabila. And then he reminded also the state of nation at this time when he came in power. It was a nation divided politically, economically, and socially. And then he gave a brief result of his presence in the head of state, the debt. He finished the debt, which was an handicap for the development, and then he appealed the people to sustain Mr. Tshisekedi, not in a sort of cohabitation, but in kind of a coalition of progressive forces so that they can aim the same objective and reach the same result. In conclusion, he said that he leaves power without regret, because he have left the country to his successor. He left a country in progress in democracy point of view and economically also, because the objective now is emergency at around 2030.
Thank you very much, Mr. Atundu. Always nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you, James.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo Coalition. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Comments by Italy's Deputy Prime Minister accusing France of impoverishing African countries have created a split between the two European nations. At the heart of the dispute is migration into Europe following the deaths of hundreds of refugees in the Mediterranean Sea of Libya in recent days. As Henry Richwell reports, the argument is likely an indication of bitter divisions that will be laid bare across the continent in the run-up to European elections in May.
Already frosty relations between Paris and Rome have taken an icy turn. France summoned the Italian ambassador to explain these comments made Sunday by Italy's deputy prime minister.
If today we still have people leaving Africa, it's due to several European countries. First of all, France, that didn't finish colonizing Africa.
Di Maio accused France of impoverishing 14 African countries that use the CFA franc, a colonial-era currency underpinned by the French Treasury, and forcing people to flee to Europe.
The actual benefits of the CFA franc are disputed by economists. However, Di Maio's criticisms aren't really valid. Now, there's two reasons for that. One of them being that people arriving into Italy at the moment, the latest data suggests they are not from countries using the CFA franc. And the second point is that in any case, if countries remain poor, migration is actually lower.
The Franco-Italian dispute follows the drowning of hundreds of migrants off Libya in recent days. The deaths have renewed the focus on Italy's decision to end search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean and the EU's failure to share refugee quotas.
Italy wanting France to take migrants who arrive on its shores, or at least a part of them, and also disagreements over how to handle Libya, with Italy and France backing different sides in the Libyan civil war.
President Macron has not responded directly. He has sought to renew EU momentum with a new Franco-German treaty signed Tuesday in the border town of Aachen.
Les eurosceptiques.
The Eurosceptics, nationalists, benefit from the fear in Europe's people. And they say the answer on your fears is nationalism. And we don't believe this.
The dispute is a taste of what's to come as populist forces like Italy's Five Star and La Liga join battle with pro-Europeans.
This contraposition has been created whereby Italy is the populists and Macron is the Europeanist. And it suits both sides, in a sense, to have each other as the bogeyman. Of course, this is especially important in light of the upcoming European Parliament elections.
Those election campaigns are expected to be bitter, with migration at the heart of the debate over Europe's future. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 24th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone civil society organizations and NGOs are again appealing to the government of President Julius Maada Bio to reconsider its new NGO policy. The policy requires both local and international NGOs as well as civil society organizations to register with an umbrella organization for NGOs in Sierra Leone. It also requires NGOs to hire a minimum of 4 staff before commencing operations and to align their program with the government's development agenda. Ibrahim Talmi is executive director of the Center for Accountability and the Rule of Law in Sierra Leone. He says the new policy hinders the operations of NGOs.
We are concerned about the fact that this policy
intrude into our space as civil society organizations, and it also restricts us first participating in the society that we think is constitutionally guaranteed. These are some of the major gripes we have with the policy. First, under both national and international law, citizens have the right to form groupings or associations as long as those associations are not inimical to the interest or security of the state. What this policy is essentially now saying is that we cannot form those groups or associations without extensive intrusion by the state. The policy creates barriers into the civil society space in that it is requiring, for example, all organizations or persons who intend to set up organizations to have a minimum of 4 employees. In other words, to start even a local community-based organization, you ought to have 4 employees on your payroll, and that excludes drivers or domestic staff.
This policy came about under President Ernest Bai Koroma, who had argued that it was necessary for the government to increase its oversight of the activities of non-state actors, thereby ensuring the effective utilization of public resources. Does it mean that the government supports the NGOs?
The truth is that, yes, there is a policy called the NGO policy of 2009. Yes, civil society organizations, we told the previous administration that it was a bad policy. And there were efforts, several efforts to review that policy. We had several meetings and made recommendations. Now, that policy or the revised policy was in the works when this administration took over. What this administration has done is to take on board wholesale, or let's say with very few changes, include that into what it now calls the Development Cooperation Framework, which essentially hasn't changed anything. In fact, it makes it worse.
At the moment, Mr. Tomey, you, the civil society groups, are you talking to the government probably to revise this policy?
Basically, that's a major part of the appeal, the statement that we issued a few days ago. We appealed to the president, and I'd like to use this opportunity to renew that appeal for the president to reopen this process, because we believe that there's a lot that we can talk about, there's a lot that we can change without necessarily adversely affect the primary objectives of this policy. The government says the primary objectives include promoting transparency, accountability, and coordination in the sector. We are all for that. But when you create such huge, onerous conditions for us to register organizations, I think there's an opportunity for us to have a conversation about this and make sure that we have a policy that promotes a win-win agenda for both government and CSOs.
Ibrahim Talmi is the executive director of the Center for Accountability and Rule of Law in Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital of Freetown. The South Sudan government says it has resumed oil production in its former unity state, where production was halted in 2013 when fighting broke out. The head of the petroleum authority says the Toma and Unity oil fields are now producing about 20,000 barrels per day. Winnie Shirino reports from Juba.
Awoh Daniel Chuang, Director General of the Petroleum Authority, says several oil fields in the former Unity State that were badly damaged during the four-year conflict will be repaired.
By the 31st of December 2018, also, we resumed the production in Unity oil fields, which is part of the same block, 114. And then currently, we are also working to resume the rest of the fields because we have 5 fields in that area. So now we can say that we have 2 fields that are already on stream, and the rest of the field, which is Manga, and then Nar, and then Al-Har, will be coming on board as well very soon.
Chuang says South Sudan began pumping an additional 15,000 to 20,000 barrels per day this week from its oil fields in former Unity State.
In Unity, the production is still very limited. It's around maybe 4,000 something. In Thomas House, we're producing something like 16 to 17,000. So around 2021 total at the moment. But because we have only opened up a small number of wells because of the power.
Chuang says when a new power generating plant opens in Juba, it will enable the government to increase oil production in the area to 60,000 barrels per day by the end of the year.
If we have enough power, then now we can open more. And when we open more, then of course we should be expecting more oil from Unity. activity as well. And that's why we're expecting the production to increase.
Chuang says energy shortages, along with a limited capacity at Khartoum's oil refinery, affects the amount of crude oil being extracted from Block 5A, which is currently producing 4,000 barrels per day.
The crude oil quality that is being produced in Block 5A is quite limited in terms of production. And the fact that it is limited, not because it is technically limited, but it is being limited by Khartoum refinery, because Khartoum refinery does not accommodate quality of crude oil that is very heavy, because we are producing a very heavy crude oil from Tarjas, and that's why the limitation is quite obvious.
Chuang also says South Sudan loses a significant amount of crude during the extraction process. He says the government plans to utilize enhanced oil recovery technology designed to increase the oil recovery rate and production. India's Oil and Natural Gas Corporation, which is called ONGC Vindesh, Malaysia's Petronas, and China National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC, all have stakes in South Sudan's oil fields. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The first ever international conference on Lassa fever was held this month in Abuja, Nigeria. The disease kills more than 5,000 people annually, but this is the first time researchers have been brought together on a global scale. Doctors Without Borders head of mission for Nigeria, Andrew Mills, spoke to Ricky Shryak about the potential to develop a vaccine for Lassa fever and more.
I think the biggest challenge that the medical community faces today in trying to respond to the Lassa fever outbreak, which is both endemic and we see moments of acute outbreak, is that actually it's still very much an unknown disease. It's been very much an infected disease for the last 50 years. And it's only in the last few years that there's been greater investment in academic understanding of the disease. And we're only now, today, really pulling those lessons from academia and turning them into practical implementation on the ground and being able to treat patients.
How do you think bringing together these people at this conference in Abuja, how do you think this could potentially help that response?
You know, it's a good question, because I do think it's an exciting opportunity. There is academic research going on in Nigeria, but there also is in Sierra Leone and Liberia. We also see in the United Kingdom and in the United States, suddenly a new emphasis on trying to better understand the Lassa virus. And we hope over the next few years to even develop a vaccine that will help protect communities and at-risk people such as healthcare workers. So I think having the first conference here in Nigeria, pulling together all that research that's happening across West Africa and globally, has a real opportunity to link academia together and hopefully maximize the learning that's going on around the world. And the very exciting thing, of course, is to see that it's happening here in West Africa, in the region that sees the highest burden of the disease. It's very exciting to see it being the at the forefront of new learning and academic research today in the world.
Have the Ebola outbreak had any impact on the approach to Lassa as well?
So it's true, of course, that Ebola is a viral hemorrhagic fever disease, and Lassa is a viral hemorrhagic fever disease. So, of course, we learned quite a lot from the large outbreak in West Africa, and which is ongoing today, sadly, in Eastern Congo as well, in how to respond to Ebola, and in particular, how to protect healthcare workers in treating cases of Ebola. And some of those lessons that we learned in those outbreaks over the last few years from Ebola, we have brought over to treat, to protecting healthcare workers in treating people with Lassa fever. So there's certainly some parallels and some lessons to be drawn. I think the differences which people should recognize, Lassa fever is an endemic disease, and it really occurs throughout the year, and it's a slow-burning disease which actually affects many more people than Ebola does.
That was Andrew Mills, Doctors Without Borders head of mission for Nigeria. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Abuja. The
death Wednesday of Zimbabwe music icon Oliver Umtukudzi brought Zimbabweans together in the midst of tensions sparked by fuel shortages and other economic hardships that forced a shutdown over the past few days. The 66-year-old musician, who died in a Harare hospital, brought praise from Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his political rival, Movement for Democratic Change leader Nelson Chamisa. In a press statement, President Mnangagwa described Umtukudzi as an expression of Zimbabwean identity, a man of humble character. Chamisa, for his part, described the late Umtukudzi as an icon to the nation.
We have lost a giant in the music industry. We have lost an icon of our culture, of our history, a calabash of wisdom, a man full of sense of humor, a father, a loving father, a great advisor, a mentor to me, a mentor to generation, an icon to a nation. The man who entertained the nation, who also educated the nation, who gave wise counsel to the nation, a man who developed the nation. And that Umtukudzi for you. He was everything to many. He was all things to all people. He did everything that you would expect from a complete human being. He said everything. He was a luminary, a great man on the continent and indeed in the world. But he never showed that he was a man of elevated stature and great status in society.
That was Nelson Chamisa, the leader of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change, in a tribute to Zimbabwe music icon Oliver Umtukudzi, who passed away Wednesday. Umtukudzi, the late Zimbabwe music icon. And that is it for this Thursday, January 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.